Walking out of the service this past week, I was just thinking about tumbleweeds. And I don't think I'll ever be able to watch an old Western the same way again.
It's such a vivid image, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pastor Ken has this way of, rooting these huge theological ideas in the actual dirt of his hometown.
Literally in the dirt. I mean, Garden City, Kansas, I knew it was dry, but I had no idea it was exporting tumbleweeds to Hollywood dry. That one detail just, it really stuck with me. That there's some set decorator in LA who calls a lady in Kansas to buy dead weeds.
Because she's the world's leading supplier of desolation.
Exactly. It's wild. And it sets the stage perfectly for the whole sermon.
It really does. He's describing a place where they don't even really use the word rain. They talk about moisture.
Yeah, and they measure it in what, tenths of an inch?
Tenths of an inch. It's a landscape that's just, it's defined by what it lacks.
Which brings us to the Arkansas River, or as I've been corrected a few times since Sunday, the Arkansas River.
The river that isn't really a river.
Right. And this part is so crucial, especially for anyone in our Connect groups this week who might have missed the setup.
Okay, yeah.
The river isn't dry because of a drought, not really. It's dry because of politics.
Colorado dammed it up.
They dammed it up.
Yeah.
So you have this sand trap running through town that people literally drive their jeeps across. It's not a river, it's a road.
Until the lawsuit.
Ah, the Kansas miracle. Kansas sues Colorado, wins the water rights for just one summer, and then boom, the floodgates open.
And the way Kent described that summer, it was chaos.
Total chaos. Roads that were built on the riverbed just washed away, but it was also joy.
He said they were out there floating on it every single day.
Every day. But the part that really hit me, the part that connects everything, wasn't the swimming. It was the biological shift he described.
That was the first aha moment for me, too. He mentioned how the U.S. government had spent years, and who knows how much money, back in the 1800s, trying to force a forest to grow there.
Yeah, they planted millions of trees.
Millions. They tried to engineer life in a desert, and it just failed. The trees died.
Because you can't manufacture a forest if you don't have water.
But the second the river actually flowed, life just, it just erupted. He talked about greenery popping up almost overnight.
A tangled mess of vegetation.
Exactly. Life found a way, like instantly. You didn't need to plant the trees, you just had to add the water.
And that right there, that's the whole thesis for what we're looking at here at Harmony. We spend so much energy trying to plant trees, you know.
Try to manufacture that feeling of church or force spiritual growth.
Yeah. But Kent's point is that right now we're seeing the water return.
The green shoots.
The green shoots. He's seeing people find their purpose. The connect groups are filling up. People are finding their people. The spiritual river is starting to flow again.
But, and this is where the sermon took that hard left turn. If the river's flowing.
History tells us things are about to get messy before they get better.
Because when a river flows into a dry riverbed, it doesn't just bring life. It exposes all the junk that was buried in the sand.
And to understand that, we have to leave Kansas and go all the way back to 2 Chronicles.
A completely different kind of dry riverbed.
This is the part that I think we really need to sit with for our groups this week. Because when you read these names in the Bible, Ahaz, Hezekiah, they can feel like, I don't know, cardboard cutouts.
So distant.
Yeah, but the picture Kent painted of King Ahaz, I mean, this guy wasn't just a bad leader, he was a monster.
We've got to place him on the timeline. This is the kingdom of Judah. It's a time of civil war. The nation is split. North versus South.
Okay.
Ahaz is king of the South, but he starts acting like the wicked kings of the North. He's politically desperate. He's probably terrified of the Assyrian Empire breathing down his neck, and he just starts making these terrible deals.
Spiritual deal.
He brings back the worship of the Baals. These are fertility gods, bulls. But it gets so much darker. He starts using the Valley of Ben Hinnom.
Okay, I've read the New Testament a dozen times, but I never connected the dots on this until Sunday. The Valley of Ben Hinnom is a real place.
A physical place just outside Jerusalem. But it's also the origin of our word for hell.
Gehenna.
Gehenna. That's the Greek term Jesus uses. And it comes from the Hebrew Gehinnom, the Valley of Hinnom.
So when Jesus talks about hell, he's not using some abstract, cloudy language. He's pointing to a real, very smelly valley that everyone listening to him knew.
They knew it intimately.
Yeah.
Because by Jesus' time, it was the city dump. It was where they burned trash and the bodies of criminals.
But the reason it became the dump, the reason it was considered cursed ground, that goes back to Ahaz.
It goes back to the fires. Ahaz didn't just worship idols there, he sacrificed his own children.
It's just, It's hard to even process that. A sitting king taking his own sons.
The level of desperation must have been absolute. You have to imagine a man so consumed by fear, so convinced that Yahweh has abandoned him, that he turns to Molech.
You can't describe the statue.
The bronze beast with the outstretched arms, heated from below until they glowed red. It is the ultimate inversion of what a father should be. Instead of protecting his children, he feeds them to the fire to buy himself some political safety.
And he didn't even stop there. He shut the doors of the temple.
And he cut up the holy articles. I think that detail is so important. He didn't just lock the door. He vandalized the inside.
He stripped the gold.
Probably to pay off foreign armies.
Yeah.
And he basically told the whole nation, God doesn't live here anymore. We are on our own.
It is the definition of a dry riverbed. The flow of grace was just completely dammed up.
And when Ahaz finally died, the people knew exactly who he was. They didn't even bury him in the royal tombs.
Which is a huge insult in that culture.
It's massive. You're supposed to be gathered with your ancestors. Ahaz was left out. Kent called him a turkey, which got a laugh.
It did.
But the reality is just tragic. He died a total pariah.
So that's the landscape. A traumatized nation, a desecrated temple, a cursed valley. And then his son, Hezekiah, takes the throne. He's 25 years old.
And you just have to wonder what his childhood was like. He saw his brothers disappear. He watched his father descend into this madness. Statistically, Hezekiah should have been a disaster.
Right. Trauma usually just creates more trauma.
Well, it wasn't.
No.
And Kent gives a lot of credit to his mother, Abijah. We don't know much about her. But in a record that usually skips over the moms, her name is listed.
That's a good point.
She must have kept the memory of David, of true faith, alive in that boy's heart while his father was bringing the world down.
So Hezekiah becomes king. And he doesn't wait. He doesn't form a committee or do a six-month listening tour.
The first month of the first year. Kent thinks it was literally New Year's Day. The second he had the power, he unlocked the doors his father had shut.
But opening the doors is just the beginning. This is where that river analogy comes roaring back.
Right, because you can open the floodgates, but the channel is still full of filth.
16 days. That's how long it took the priests and the Levites just to carry out the junk.
Can you imagine?
I was trying to picture it. It's not just dusting the pews. We're talking decades of neglect. Plus Ahaz's vandalism, plus whatever pagan junk had been dragged in there. It's a hoarding situation.
It's a full-on hazmat situation. The text is explicit. They're carrying the filth out to the Kidron Valley.
Yeah.
Physically removing the barriers between the people and God.
And once the space is clean, Hezekiah does something even crazier. He sends invitations to the north.
To the enemy.
The people they're at war with. The people his father hated.
He invites them to Passover. Mm-hmm. It's this brilliant, maybe desperate move for unity. He's basically saying, I don't care about the politics. I care about the worship. Come home.
And the response to that brings us to the core of this week's discussion for our groups. The temple is open. Worship is restored. The water is hitting the dry ground. So what happens next?
Well, you might expect, I don't know, a big celebration, a concert, a lot of weeping, maybe.
And I'm sure there was some of that.
Oh, for sure. But the text in 2 Chronicles highlights a very specific, very tangible response.
The heaps.
Hezekiah reinstates the support for the ministry. He says, you know, the priests need to eat so they can focus on God's law, not on farming.
And the people respond with so much generosity that the food and supplies just pile up in these mounds that you can see from a distance.
And this is where we have to talk about first fruits, because I think we lose the power of that concept today.
It's not the same as a tip.
Not at all. It's the difference between a tip and a tribute. First fruits means you harvest your field, and before you feed your family, before you see if you even have enough for the winter.
You take the very best part right off the top and bring it to the temple.
It requires a massive amount of trust.
It requires believing the river is going to keep flowing. If you think the water is going to shut off tomorrow, you hoard every drop.
But if you believe God has opened the floodgates, you give. The heaps were physical proof that the people believed the drought was finally over.
And of course, they brought the tithe.
The full 10%.
Now, I really appreciated how Kent navigated this part, because the moment a pastor says tithe or money, our defense mechanisms just go right up.
Of course. We've all seen the scandals. We've all heard the line that the church is just a business.
And that's a valid cynicism in our culture. We've been burned. But Kent's rebuttal was so sharp.
What did he say? A business keeps its profit.
A church invests everything back into people.
Right. But he didn't actually ask for money.
No, and that's the key thing. He explicitly said, I'm not asking you for a check today. He wants to do the theology first.
He wants to unpack why we give and who it belongs to before he asks anyone to do anything. He's de-weaponizing the topic.
He's treating us like adults. He's just saying, look, the pattern in scripture. Revival happens, hearts turn, and then hands open.
Generosity isn't the fee you pay to get into the club. It's the reflex of a heart that realizes it's been rescued.
Which brings us to the title of the sermon. Hezekiah looks at these priests, these guys who are exhausted from hauling out 16 days of trash, and he says,
"My sons, do not be negligent now."
It's such a haunting phrase. Do not be negligent now. The work is hard. The cleanup is messy. The momentum is building. Don't fall asleep. Don't get distracted.
And this is a challenge for all of us in our Connect groups. Kent brought this right down to our level. He called us his sons and daughters in the faith.
He talked about our bags of gold, our talents, our influence, our time.
The sphere of influence.
Right. We all have one. Maybe it's the guys you play basketball with or the other moms at the school pickup line. That's your riverbed.
And if the water's flowing at Harmony, it should be flowing into those conversations.
But those conversations are invisible. You can't, like, see a spiritual conversation.
Unless you use a ping pong ball.
The KIM, the Kingdom Impact Meter.
I love that they have a physical acronym for this.
Okay, walk us through the green ping pong ball challenge, because this is the homework for the week.
It's a way to make the inventable visible. The church has these clear containers. They're basically colanders.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is simple. Anytime you have one of those green shoot conversations, talking about God, praying with someone, sharing what you're learning in a natural way.
Not weird or forced.
Not weird or forced.
Yeah.
You just put a green ping pong ball in the container on Sunday.
It sounds like a game, but the psychology behind it is exactly the same as the heaps in 2 Chronicles.
It is. The heaps were visual proof that the people were all in. The ping pong balls are our version of that. It's a way of saying, we aren't just consumers sitting in rows on Sunday.
We're active participants.
Yeah. If you see that container filling up, you start to realize, oh, wow, the church is actually working.
It totally shifts the metric. Success isn't how good was the sermon. Success is how many balls are in the bucket.
Which puts the ball literally in our court.
So let's pull this all together for the discussion this week. We started with a dry riverbed in Kansas where the government failed to make life grow.
We saw the water return and life just sprung up effortlessly.
We tracked that same idea through the nightmare of Ahaz, who dammed up the spiritual river with fear and idolatry, to the courage of Hezekiah, who just broke the doors open on day one.
And we landed on the response. When the river flows, we don't just sit there. We clean house, we worship, and we give. We create heaps of evidence that we've been changed.
So here's the question I think we need to wrestle with. Hezekiah warned them against negligence. Do not be negligent now. If you look at your life right now, your sphere of influence, your resources, your attention, where is the negligence creeping in?
That's the hard question. It's easy to get excited about a revival at church. It's so much harder to ask, am I the one standing in the way of the water reaching my neighbors?
Or am I holding back my first fruits because I'm scared the river's going to dry up again?
Fear is usually the root of negligence, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're afraid it won't last, so we don't fully commit.
But the water is on, the green shoots are popping up. The challenge this week is to just grab a paddle and get in the river. And hey, if you have that conversation,
don't forget to drop the green ball in the bucket on Sunday.
I want to see those heaps. Let's fill it up.
Let's do it.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you next week.